The list of people test. No, it's sitting over here. Do your deal. People are going to be coming and going, and members will be coming and moving in and out. So I'll apologize in advance. I think there's that many people here. It's probably because there aren't. Anyway, so I don't know where the DFL members are, but do they know we're here in this room?
Yeah, they're never noticed.
Yeah, no one hanging around downstairs.
I can go check.
Did you put a note there saying that we're up here?
Yep. Anyway, first we're going to do the commercial parts later on. But so in the meantime, we want to hear from a special group. Tom Spencer has got an idea, and part of it, are the health plans here that I want them to hear about this wonderful idea. The question that intrigued me about this is this group has developed a really cool way to solve a very difficult problem, and without being unduly ripping on any particular health plans that start with a B. The question is, how do you take an idea from being a really good idea that makes a lot of sense to be incorporated into a covered benefit, or at least a known thing? Well, one way I know of it is to pass a law, which only covers about 30% of the people in the state, which is another way is to actually just present the idea. And it's just it makes an interesting question about that as an object lesson, but it's also a fascinating topic about the diabetic wound piece. As it's also a cost-effective way to do this thing, so it fits our committee for our division for a couple different reasons. So, welcome, Tom Spencer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Spencer. I'm president of Advanced Healing Systems. I wish to thank you and the Cost Containment Committee for hearing some testimony this afternoon from Minnesota citizens with chronic wounds. Before we begin, I would like to call your attention to the handout that each of you should have received. So all the committee members should have a handout. And there are three sections in this handout. One is the presentation slides. The next section is the presentation documentation, and finally are the presentation studies. So if you don't have that, make sure that Jason gets your copy of it. I've been told that we have 10 minutes to present, so we'll try to keep it to 10 minutes. And since we have several witnesses today, I will ask that each of the witnesses identify her or himself in turn. Minnesota citizens with chronic wounds has proposed a new diabetes guideline. The guideline would reduce or prevent amputations by 80% by healing early stage diabetic ulcers and wounds. I call your attention to the financial impact heading. And I guess we've got so many people in here, I don't dare use my laser pointer, but it's right there.
Everybody duck.
Yeah. And based on the Department of Health report to the legislature in 2005, and also based on the Mayrovitz study, which is included in your packet at the end, we would project that we would prevent 713 amputations at a cost savings to Minnesota payers of $28.5 million a year. We would do that based upon an average cost per case in each amputation of $40,000. The guideline objective is actually very, very simple. It is to prevent stage 2 and stage 3 diabetic ulcers and wounds before they turn into chronic conditions, and before those chronic conditions lead to amputation, which, depending upon whose data you look at, range from anywhere from 800 in Minnesota to 2,000 a year. The guideline benefit is also very, very clear, and that is complete healing of wounds that are chronic. So I just want to make sure we all understand, when we have treated patients through the medical professionals that we work with this therapy, 9 out of 10 of these patients are completely healed after many, many months and many cases of treatment. I would like to have one of the witnesses comment on the slides on the wall. Jim?
Actually, maybe you should kind of...
Would you stand up and identify
identify yourself?
Yeah, just, yeah.
Jim Wren or James Leslie Wren. This is my wife. I had to have my little toe amputated because I had an injury to it that was not healing. As you can see, it progressively got better, and I believe that without this machine, it would not have healed at all. And I probably would have ended up losing my life. The last slide, there's a gentleman that's shielding his eyes. The last slide shows the completely what the doctors would call epithelialized wound. And this is the end stage of Jim's treatment with what's called pulse radio frequency electromagnetic therapy, PREMF. The next slide, again, goes to the main benefit of this therapy, which is complete healing. Now, unfortunately, we don't get people when they're not healed. We get them when the medical community and all of its resources have failed to progress these patients to closure or a meaningful health outcome. Carol, perhaps you could comment on this slide.
Certainly. My name is Carol Schallbetter. And for 3 years, a stasis ulcer on my right leg was worked on using conventional medical treatment. After 6 months, it has more than half healed. It was yay big, now it's yay big. And I couldn't be more grateful. The machine has worked for me like nothing else ever has.
And I would make one final comment here in the last slide. We started with Carol treating one half of her leg because the wound actually was almost encompassing the entire calf area. So the last slide in the right corner shows a completely healed part of the leg where we focused the therapy to begin with, and now we're continuing on the other side. And you can see there have been some spillover benefits simply from the treatment of the one side of the leg. This is another case also treated by PREMF therapy. And Dr. Spencer, perhaps you would comment on what you're looking at on the screen.
Well, the initial heel ulcer was the primary problem. The amputation that you see was a secondary problem because it did not have primary closure. They were unable to close it primarily with at the site. The ultimate or the far corner picture is the closure after treatment with radiotherapy. This would have been either another amputation, a secondary follow-up, or a complete limb removal. This is an impressive slide in that it showed what could be done if we had gotten that heel ulcer much, much earlier in the course of therapy.
This is another case of a patient that we're treating through a RISC program contracted with the state of Minnesota in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'd just like to point out a couple of things. And again, Doctor, if you feel like commenting, please do. But in the upper left-hand corner, we got this gentleman, and they were telling him because of the systemic infection that was now attacking the bone in the fifth metatarsal or the little toe, they told him that he was likely to lose his foot in a very recent or immediate period. The second slide to the right on the top is the underside of that same wound. Within 2 weeks, we had the wound closed without any other antibiotic interventions, and there was no infection present, and he healed 2 weeks later completely.
Good.
All right. The final picture that I'll show you today is from the skilled nursing facility in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and perhaps the administrator would like to comment on what you're looking at.
I'd love to. My name is Jean Shelby. I'm a nursing home administrator with Health East out in White Bear Lake. This is a picture of one of our diabetic residents that was treated with this methodology, and as you can see, that the treatment was completely healed. You know, what I'd like to say is that when I was approached about doing a pilot project with this equipment, I kind of laughed and said, this is Star Trek space age. I would not have even looked at it except that Dr. Spencer is our medical director. So I said, great, we'll try anything. you know, we brought it in, we used it on all of our diabetic people. We picked out our people, but with the worst chronic wounds, it was it healed all of them. So we went on to work with peripheral vascular disease. The technology is amazing, and I cannot say enough good things about it. I've never been tears when we had the Focal Pilot Project. It's non-invasive. It's very low labor time. It's phenomenal. I can't say enough good things about it. I believe that this is something that should be accessible to anybody that uses it. And you know, the one thing that is yet to be explored is the preventative measures. When people are initially starting to break down, if this technology were used, you would never see these changes. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Please. My name is Dr. David Spencer. Hello, Jim.
Hello. Welcome.
This is my 46th year of practice. I started the geriatric program at the University of Minnesota in family medicine. I've taught at several universities. I've played the game on both sides of the field, that is, with the academic research protocols, with the HMO protocols for approval. This is an FDA-approved project. What interested me in it initially was that it looked like a simple technology. What has intrigued me even further is that this can be brought into nursing homes all over the state of Minnesota. It can be utilized without technical competence in that you're addressing a wound. I don't care how you want to treat the wound. You simply can address this over any current treatment that's going on, and it will show benefits. The other thing that's intriguing about it is it looks to me like that last slide that you looked at with the cubitus ulcers with chronic alterations in nursing homes. We could change the landscape very simply. We've been trying to look at some ways to do some research projects or some pilot projects on this, but bottom line, what we found at White Bear was that simply if we got some nurses, the administration involved, we got results that were absolutely stunning and surprising almost. What we haven't been able to do is figure out how to break into the system to get coding or approval. We can, Tennessee, I think, has given approval for coding if you have pain and edema. Well, I can teach most of the doctors that I've trained over the years to include pain and edema, but the people that are practicing outstate Minnesota in the small rural facilities don't have time to have a full-time coder to keep up with the gamesmanship that goes on with the approval process. So what we were trying to do was to figure out a way to short-circuit, to take a look. I think that we would be willing to look at any kind of standardized protocol. As a matter of fact, I think one of the things that I've looked at is give us your worst nursing home and let us see if we can make a difference. But somehow, let's break the system, because you folks cannot afford the current medical cost, and you do have to be involved in cost containment.
Thank you very much.
I can
just kind of summarize now.
Some other comments, but I wanted to mention that when I went back and talked to our staff about the fact that Tom had asked me to testify today, what they had validated for me is that the wounds that this product healed, they're not breaking down again. It's actually healed the wound up to the point where they are staying healed. That's unusual in the HR
Jim,
do you
want to end it? Well,
time is other slides, but they're all examples of rejection.
You're about 17 minutes into your time, so.
Okay. Well, we want to be careful, but we.
Well, you made your point, and I and members, somebody came late. The reason for this is not just a nice way to look at how to heal a wound, which is actually a nice way how to heal a wound, but how do you how does a new technology that will save money and do better work break into the system? That's the question. This is the object lesson that I was impressed when I heard the presentation originally. I thought it really had somewhere to go in terms of, I don't know what the answer to your question, but at least you presented a very compelling presentation about how do we move the ball forward. So I think if you want to talk about that for a minute, we could. If members have questions for the witnesses, that's kind of a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about long-term wounds, like they've been there for 3 or 4 years on diabetic-related?
Yeah. I can tell you, in all honesty, we don't get anybody that hasn't failed in the current medical system. So, in a conversation that was had with a doctor at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Minneapolis this morning, his comment was, yes, we know the VA has approved this treatment. However, we have to bring it through our own committee here because we do our own thing in Minneapolis. And we said, well, doctor, how about we start with the 10 patients that you can't heal that also have diabetic complications? And he said, that sounds like a great place to start. Let's see what we can do.
And Mr. Chair, and you did that.
We did.
And they out, Mr. Chair, they were all healed?
Well, we're just starting.
Oh, you're just starting.
We're just starting.
Thank you.
Even though the VA approved this in the fall of 2004 for use in all Veterans Administration hospitals, we now have to go through another committee to get it going over there. But in fact, he's going to give us 10 patients that they haven't been able to heal for years.
I wish there were more plans here, because otherwise you go through a little dance about what code, and if you have include the right co-elements, and it's
well,
paid,
I,
and...
Mr. Chairman, if you'll permit me. This is interesting. This is exactly where the medical delivery system is today, and I recognize some acquaintances from the plans in the room, and this is no cut on them. What you see is the first written explanation by the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association of America as to why on the new HCPCS code that became effective January 1st, 2005, they will not pay submitted Medicare claims. You've got this in your documents. You can look it over. This is the first written rejection. What they told us was this. Yes, we recognize that a new HCPCS code was awarded, but it doesn't correlate with the FDA's approval. So since it doesn't correlate on that technicality, we're not going to pay claims. What makes this so amazing is the following slide, and this is even after the National Association of Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans were signatories right here on the decision issued November 1st, 2004. So they said, we're approving a new wound care device because we think it has medical benefits. But now the plans have come out and said, based on the technicality, we're not going to pay claims. And the plans would save money, Mr. Chair.
It seems reasonable to me.
You've done a very good job. Anybody else want to listen, Bradley? Anybody have any questions for this sentiment?
Well, it's interesting, and I think it just shows the dilemma. I don't know about that slide when I even asked you to come, but it's a worthy discussion. So thank you very much.
And members, if you have further, there's a whole the honors course. You've got the entire manual to teach the course.
Very complete. Thank you, Mr. Spencer.
Appreciate
thank
coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Thanks a lot. Oh, is she in the education committee? Yeah, why don't we do that health report thing? Sorry, what do you want to do your health report? Your mental health thing?
Okay, get Mindy.
Yeah, we'll get her back.
She just left.
We'll get her until we work on that.
Okay.
We're going to kind of jump around. I didn't see Tim or Jim. Are they coming? Barb, do you want to do your... Do you have a... Well, we're just let's actually do the commercial part now. What we're going to do is we're going to start reviewing some language. People like language at the legislature, and so actually there's been language introduced on various topics, and so or nearly introduced. And so I've asked a few of the members on the committee and otherwise to comment on some things that have passed the main division, the main committee, in the case of the Wilkin Oblock projects. But in the case of Thiessen and Goodwin, those are proposed projects, and that's when Bradley's work was discussed last year. So, maybe
Barb, you just want to give us.
I think in your folders you have a copy of. It was a draft. I don't think it was introduced. It has no. There's no bill number. Is that right? Yeah, it's 053484. So, if you, let's take just a few minutes and give us an overview and interrogate you otherwise. Thank
okay.
You. That's
Mr. Goodwin. Mr. Chair and members, I feel like maybe one of the big problems that we have in trying to maintain health care costs is that the consumer rarely knows what they're going to be charged for procedures that are done in their clinics and doctor's offices. And they are rarely told about lower cost alternatives that might be available. So this bill would basically they would have to tell the consumer about what the amounts are going to be charged to them for their health care services. And the one thing I think is pretty wide open here is if the person requests it, and I would rather see that they do it whether or not the person requests it, because in my work in the medical field in the past, patients were very afraid to ask their doctors or their administrative staff what the services would cost. Whether or not they're under insurance, they should have this information. They should know what they're going to pay. We've tried the fee-for-service model for many, many years now, and all it's done is increase the cost of health care. So when you have to go, the guy that repairs your car has to call you with an estimate if it's going to cost over $100, yet you can go into the thousands of dollars on medical care without getting information about what it's going to cost you. It's time to make some changes there. We've waited for this too long. In the past, as I brought this issue up, the insurance industry says that they support that idea. The HMOs have said they support that idea, this idea. And so I think it has general acceptance. I know there were a couple of things that were done a couple of years ago, but I think this is a little tougher than that. I would also like to see, there's a couple other things that aren't in this bill that I would like to see, and that is I'd like to see rates posted. I did research several years ago on the healthcare industry and how easy it is to get access to fees, and did a random sample of 500 doctors' offices in the metropolitan area and found that overwhelming majority of cases, there was no way to get that information. And I tried to use the exact same procedure with everyone, and all I ever got was it depends, or call our business office, and then they would say it depends, and it's very difficult, if not impossible, for people to get that information. And that was the conclusion of my research, and that research won a statewide competition. It was called healthcare cost containment, basically. So I think we do need to make it easier for whether a person is insured or not, for them to understand what their costs are going to be before they incur those costs.
That's some good when you surveyed. And did you find they just didn't know the price, or did they charge different prices, or was there one price from different prices from the same place for the same CPT code?
Interestingly, Mr. Chair, the ones that did give me the prices, which were some, there was a big variation for the same procedure in different from different physicians,
but
different
the same
doctors'
place,
offices.
The same prices at one place.
Right. I didn't call the same place twice, so I don't know if I would have gotten two different answers, but that would have been a good follow-up study.
Well, I appreciate it. And then, obviously, the reimbursement rates vary. I think we're prohibited from having two prices, last I heard. But what we get reimbursed as a provider is all across the board, depending upon who's paying. And so I appreciate that. Any questions for some Goodwin members?
I know you and I are both downstairs too at the same time here, but I'm here and you're here, so I guess we're even now. Huh? But you had a work group on the mental health topic, and I believe you want to give us a report. You and Representative Samuelson. So either way you want to do it, take a few minutes and give handouts.
And how long are you planning to take, do you think, to do this? How long do you need to? Oh, yeah, that's fine. Oh, yeah, can do this. No, I'm just curious. That's fine. Perfect. I just heard a long list of that. Oh, man.
First of all, one area that is really specifically looks like a good area to tap into is the polypharmacy education program. These programs educate Target prescribers are to avoid large numbers of behavioral health medications and prescriptions, and people that deviate from the disconnect. The project also notifies physicians if there are patients who fail to receive refill their
point number two, then, I bet.
I was wondering if this meeting was being taped or not.
At least it is now.
One thing I want to stress before I begin with point number two, and that is that we were very cognizant as we looked at this for cost savings measures, that the mental health system is very underfunded. So in this case, we're looking for better use of the dollars that are there. And then hopefully some of the things that are underfunded can be better funded. And then we get into the circle of not having the expensive services, but the better services that usually are cheaper as well. And so number two is looking at something called evidence-based practices, treatments that work, as opposed to things that cost money that may or may not work as well. And right now there are six of these, and they include things like supported employment. If any of you were at the Mental Health Caucus when we spent an evening on that, that's a way to keep people healthy, family education, and other things. And Minnesota is currently in the process of redesigning our community mental health system, which then makes it more of a continuum of care, and people are apt to get care when they need it instead of the emergency rooms, which costs the very most.
Third area is housing versus treatment. And we're looking at affordable housing options for folks rather than being in institutionalized type treatment. There's a program called Bridges that basically works with folks, people in the community, and that is based on Section 8 program. Typically, Bridges subsidy costs about $13 a day, which is really expensive. And currently, there's 30% of the patients at ANOCA that really don't need to be there and can benefit by some type of independent community living.
The next one is flexible dollars, and I know that those of you who are on the regular health committee have done a lot with that I think is very important work. Having the dollars be flexible enough so they can be used on what works and what is needed at the time instead of what, some narrow mandates that end up costing more and often duplicate with other services available.
Step down model. And you do have handouts that you can use on as well. And basically, this supports the development of alternative models, an alternative to use emergency rooms and inpatient hospital locations. Basically, what we want is to establish rates of crisis and crisis status, and will include mobile trainings and crisis stabilization. These areas have definitely been found to reduce costs.
The sixth one is disease management, and this is a collaborative, multidisciplinary approach currently being piloted in Texas. And there, they've kind of standardized assessment and outcomes and treatment, and then there's not so much trial and error, and the outcomes are apt to be more effective as well as more cost-effective.
In the early intervention area, basically the Mental Health Action Group has identified this as a top priority and stated that their goals in earlier intervention and secondary prevention are most beneficial to clients and definitely reduce the cost of any intensive treatment, which would be much more expensive.
The eighth one is on model benefit set, and this is also developed by the Mental Health Action Group, and I know a lot of you have been coming to the Mental Health Caucus. Tomorrow night we do have Commissioner Goodnow and Gary Cunningham from the Citizens League coming from 5 to 6 in room 200 if anyone wants to hear in person from those esteemed folks who will be giving an overview of their recommendations. But one of them is this as well, the model benefit set, and this again is to try to make sure that the treatment is cost effective and that there's a partnership with public and private sectors, and they both know what the other one is doing. And one of the handouts that you got is a copy of the model benefit sets that they're putting forward.
And then number 9, you're focusing on the people who need the services from home and develop and provide those services in community types. So there's 4 specific points here. Early intervention, ongoing monitoring and medication, or alcohol and drug use, social interaction types of services, and when it's possible, work for these folks that are in the community.
And Mr. Chair, if anyone in the committee has questions, we have with us someone to answer the hard questions. Sue Abderholden is the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota.
Thank you, and thanks for this. Is great work. Is there language that's been put together on some of these things? I see that there's a few house files referenced on the last point.
And on the first point.
Emerson.
Are these
other things that don't have language? Are they things that could be legislative, or are they more conceptual?
Person Samuelson or whoever.
Most likely both.
Mr.
Abderholden, welcome.
Sue Abderholden from NAMI Minnesota. Some of them are more conceptual, not ready necessarily yet for legislation, but you know, in the future, that may be certainly a possibility.
Person Thiessen.
That's all I have.
Well, I would just say, Mr. Chairman and members, that the governor does have in his budget proposal the hiring of two individuals to do evidence-based medicine upgrades and so on. And so certainly some of those will involve health area.
What department was that at?
It's
Human Services.
Department of Human Services.
The members got questions? And just to not get you off the hook yet, having done some, I'll call this early work, this division is charged with the private sector. I don't know how you roll some of these into private sector savings, but if there's some way to roll them into public sector savings, that would make a little bit of sense, especially in the next month or so in a different committee that a lot of us serve on. That would be the other health committee, the other committee, the other littler one there. But if there's some things that we can do, either in terms of statements of policy or urging or suggest, I don't know how you, like I was actually reading your evidence thing, one of the ways they figured it out was logical. I thought that kind of made some, at the last one on the last page, logical was a, any more logic in the system anyway, it seems like that might catch on.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the model benefit set, you know, is really a move for both the public and the private. One, so that we don't have people shifting from the private to the public sector for certain benefits. But because we know that those things do work, that we expect that the private sector would save money as well.
You know what the model set costs on an annual or monthly basis? Is there an actuary who's figuring that out?
No. But we do know that some of the health plans actually are looking at adopting some of these model benefits. There's a phase-in, as you notice on the chart, and that they are moving to doing that. The problem, of course, in mental health is that because we don't have a national parity, that, you know, with about 54% of the folks in Minnesota under a self-insured plan, no matter what we do with our plans here in Minnesota, we still leave out over half of the folks in terms of accessing good mental health services.
I appreciate that. But working in the three of you or whoever, if you can convert some of these into I'm not sure how the bill is going to read on some of these departments, but I think we want to take positions on many of these aspects. We either have statements of enthusiastic encouragement or pushing here and there and harass somebody, whatever it takes to move the ball forward. I think we'll use all those carrots that we can. And somebody was moved their hand around. Well, I appreciate that. And thank you for your work. As we go forward, I hope there's some language you can provide us with. We'll be getting to that point sometime pretty soon. Ripson and
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if our ad hoc group here, I think we might be finished, but I think a place for anyone who's interested in fleshing out any of these things that don't turn out to be in other bills, or even if they are, and we just want to work together to promote them. That's why we, both Representative Samuelson and I and a lot of people in this room are in the Mental Health Caucus. And after we have heard from the report from the action group tomorrow night, then we're having a little time to talk about, that's our last formal meeting because we know we're heading into bill deadlines and people get way too busy and I'm running back and forth thanks to the page for retrieving me from my other committee that I'll soon go to. But we would like to, talk at the end of our meeting about how are we going to work together, exactly as you're saying, Mr. Chair, to, figure out priorities, things to push for, and so forth.
And I think part of it is convincing the actuaries who work for various plans that indeed something saves money. I didn't know that there'd be I didn't know about the Blue Cross side. I was just making a joke to Phil. I don't know if he even dared come back after that. But the previous presenter criticized a particular plan, and I'm not out to, from jokes I tell, I'm not interested in bashing a particular plan, just anyone at all. But that's the joke. But we're all in this together. We need each other. We need the plans. We need little plans, big plans. For-profit, non-profit. But the trick is, how do you convince a plan that something makes sense? In the last presentation, we heard about a wound care system that made tremendous sense to me, and I've heard the presentation three times now. And it's just interesting how that's not catching on with the plans. There's some actuary somewhere who just didn't get the idea somehow, or some board of directors or somebody. But as you go forward, if we can find some way to even request reviews of stuff and to move the ball, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And the plans are all well-intended, good folks, right? They're nodding back there. Go ahead and get the last
word. Mr. Chair, the last word, and I noticed that your Cracker Jack staff, or maybe yourself, already cut out the same article, but Representative Samuelson and I passed out the one about bringing depression into focus, and it reminded me of it with your mention of a plan. Here's a plan to complement health partners, and it was in the article in the paper yesterday. Yeah, very good.
Compliment. You can get them, yeah.
They figured out if they treat depression that they save for every dollar spent $2.20. And then they highlighted in the paper that any other smart plan could read and copy. So I think that's the sort of thing we want to encourage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time for mental health.
I'm sure that's a very good plan. I'd be happy to talk to you about how they might see the values and savings of some of your ideas. So. Well, they're on a good mood. We'll get them to nod yes at that one, too. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, that says for every dollar spent on this program, we avoid medical costs of $2.20. That says nothing about the lost productivity of these individuals, which is a huge cost to the economy.
Thank you.
Yeah, but very good point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to do my commercial part, and then we'll move to Gripson and Bradley, who can talk about if you'd like. You can go from your chair if you like, or you can go to the table. In your packets, you've got a number of things, one of which we're so glad about. We gave you two copies of it, you heard. Let's see. After you get through all the big paper there, those are the bills. SEIU gave me something. They're concerned about HSAs, and I'm not sure I agree with them exactly, but I wanted them to have their plug in it. I think they're going to address us next week for a few minutes to give us their thoughts about that. This came from... One of the lobbyists gave me this quality cure here, there's some interesting articles that you'll find here that I think that worthy of reading. This rating of doctors continues on. This is a new article from the AP out of the LA Sun about doctor report cards. Good news, bad news.
having to do with the Health of Nations. It's in our article from the New Republic Online. This just came out from the Department of Health. I don't know if everybody got it, but you're going to have it now. It's a fact sheet on health insurance coverage in Minnesota. That may be old news, but it's just kind of summarizing. Another interesting thing, we've been talking about, this is the article about illness and bankruptcy. And then I was reading another journal, and someplace in here is the counterpart to this, where they criticize the article, which I think is always fun to have two people going after the same article. That's in here somewhere. I'll come up to that. Here's this depression one that was already referenced. This is out of the latest one of the papers in town, Young, Ailing, and Uninsured. This is, I think, in a Sunday paper, perhaps. Here's a blurb on fixing America's healthcare system. And there's more reading on all this stuff, but it's just amazing if you just even look a little bit. There's articles every day on this. Health spending slows is still at the highest point. You know, I've been talking a lot about alternative care. There's at least it's getting written up more about. I think in the definition of alternative care, this group we had before would be considered alternative, yet it's being done in the mainstream. And so it's a curious, you know, paradigm. But this talks about effectiveness standards, and I think that we're all kind of getting on board that you need to measure what you've done. And here's this just an interesting, total opposite view. This is the critique of the article about the bankruptcy claims and compared to the other article you just read. So that's kind of interesting. And remember, this is an honors course. There is no test given, but you will your success will be judged in the real world. So anyway, Representative Bradley speaking in the real world. You had a bill that we passed last year, and can you give us a little summary of that, please?
Okay, let me try to give you the quick view. I think there should be two items in your packet that I'll just quickly scan. One of them is 2004 legislature health care. I've used this in many settings to kind of set the stage of what's been done, what's in process, and what might be opportunities for the future. Just as a reminder to us that in 2004, actually, a great many health care cost containment reforms were passed, and that's in the left column in that sheet called health care. We did some things on consumer empowerment, getting out of the way a couple of health policies that would have made us out of compliance for health savings accounts. We did also, it was a good one, had at least a beginning language on requiring providers to give best faith estimates. You'll find yourself as you get into that field in an interesting area where you get many, many phone calls. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, what it means is you give an estimate. We also got into the field of prescription explanation of benefits, which is still being worked on. In the area of best practices or evidence-based, we had language about partnerships between providers, health plans, and payers. We suggested that there be leadership from the Department of Health and specifically pointed to diabetes, asthma, and suggested that at least two more areas be. The reason for that was when you begin to get beyond some of these areas where the science is well understood, there's really no controversy in terms of the treatment of things like diabetes as to what the best practice is, or virtually no controversy anyway, this is where you ought to focus. The big issue is to go from 50% or less compliance to something a lot better than that. And we suggested that both as a purchaser for our employees and for our health programs that we become a quality purchaser. In the third item that we got involved was a disease management for chronic, and there we basically said that Department of Human Services ought to focus on these opportunities within our own health programs. We had a little kind of a boost to the notion of electronic medical records, essentially asking the health department to get involved with the private sector, not for us to establish the standards, but for us to be a player in helping to make that happen. In the prescription drugs, we've done a lot of work in helping people access pharmaceutical assistance programs. So these things, if you can navigate through it, you'll get a really good deal. You might get free or near free drugs up to 200% of federal poverty level. We have done work in the past and did additional work in trying to enable purchasing alliances. These are with the Main Street small businesses and farmers. As a matter of fact, we think we're close to another milestone of getting Commerce Department approval with about one more letter from a reinsurance organization. The seventh item is about health player. We did a little bit in the contracting area of fairness in contracts, typically between health plans and providers. You remember that we did work last year in the surgical centers, hospitals, that added adverse reporting requirements and required people, particularly in surgical centers, to publish their economic interests. The ninth item, we had the controversy up in the St. Cloud area, and out of that came something that, as a matter of fact, is feeding us information. Just recently, the health department released something on based on this legislation, and that is a kind of a comparison of the three organizations that would like to place a hospital in Maple Grove. Item number 10, we did finally actually eliminate one mandate, the Togo's bone marrow transplant with high-dosage chemotherapy. We had some small regulation relief, and there's always little opportunities. One of them was that when the consumer's okay with it, that reports could be distributed by email. And where we had duplicate requirements and sometimes conflicting requirements between state and federal, that we could have deeming and take advantage of the federal requirements and not have to repeat that. We also passed a birth defects information system. And we did some MCHA reforms to sort of raise a little bit. We were a little bit low in our level of what we charge in MCHA. So that's sort of what we did. There have been a lot of things in the right column going on in the private market. I won't review that. You've been party to many of that. I'm oftentimes giving this presentation to employer groups, and what I always tell employer groups is you don't have to wait for the legislature to tell you what to do. There's a lot of things that you can do as a person sure already, and that's what some of these items are. And then under the more opportunities, I'll at least give you in that kind of a list, not all of these things are in House File 2, but I'm going to switch now to House File 2, and you can look through those other items as opportunities. Let me now go to the House research summary that you have in your packet on House File 2 and just give you a kind of a quick review of what you might consider in this committee and this division. We had a section on health savings account. What we suggested, actually, I think we changed the language to suggest that do or bring at least an option to the table for negotiation that would include a health savings account. We had a matter of because there's so many hospitals and health providers that are having to purchase independent interpreter services, that maybe we could somehow have a consolidated place that you could go to do that. We also have in this bill the conformance with the health savings accounts so that our tax laws will be in conformance. Article 2 on page 2 of the summary, one of the items would be, because a lot of us, I believe, realize that there's a good deal of cost shifting, that to sort of test that a bit, to actually suggest in this bill that we limit program expansion until we solve the cost shifting. And the language basically says that at least get to the point where we're paying for the cost of providers. And then there's a study called for as well on cost shifting. Article 3 has a mandated benefits moratorium called for. There's a lot of argument in this, but there are those certainly who believe that as we have additional mandates, therefore we have costs. And by the way, we know also that we apply that to our ever-shrinking part of our insured marketplace, right now estimated to be around 30%. So when people think we're coming in and we're going to solve the world when we pass a mandate, all we do is we put continued cost pressure on only about 30% of the insured marketplace. We also have, I think you're going to hear about this one, I believe this has essentially been picked up in Representative Wilkins, that's the Small Employer Alternative Benefits Act plan. You'll hear more about that. In the next page, section 3 of that article is something that I think you might want to consider. We continue to have on the books a requirement for capital expenditure reporting, even though, frankly, it's been virtually useless. So it creates tons of paper, but basically has no function. I think there's only been one or two instances in all of its years and years of existence where it actually had any bearing, where there was any action taken. So that might be an opportunity. Article 4. Gets into, I think actually did do something on the file and use reform, so that one probably has already been done. Section 2 in that article would allow for-profit HMOs, and that's based on those of us who believe in increasing competition. I'm going to skip down because the next sections down through 6 are all relating to the HMO, the for-profit HMO. Section 7, is something that would raise the minimum premiums in MCHA. Some of us believe that that 101% is not recouping enough of the expenses for MCHA, and too much is then being put on the burden of employees and small businesses. Next page, page 4, section 9, is something I think you might also want to consider from an efficiency point of view. Today, all insurance regulation is in the Department of Commerce except for HMO regulation. And we've suggested that that ought to be transferred so that we would consolidate that insurance compliance area. Article 5 is the medical malpractice, and I don't think I need to cover. We've heard that. This gets into the idea of best practices or some kind of protection that might have something to do with defensive medicine practices, places limits on punitive non-economic damages, and then deals also with attorney fees. And Mr. Chair, that's a quick summary.
Thank you very much. Members have questions? I guess we're all convinced.
I don't take it that way, Mr. Chair.
Oh, well, you might.
I've been around for a while.
Fair enough. And Representative Knobloch and Wilkin are still tied up in a meeting. I'd like to just after run off and vote. On some education matters, but I wanted to help people. We're finding our schedule time here. We may actually get done early if those other two folks don't show up. That's going to be next. But the general plan here, we spent about a month and a half. Where's the time go? So we spent 2 months listening to a whole bunch of ideas, and I hope that those of you who have been tracking this from the beginning have found some of those presentations to be productive, at least interesting, and to kind of, I hate to say open up your mind, that sounds like some kind of a ethereal thing, but I think the system is starving for some open-mindedness and some fresh looks, if you can stand those non-fresh terms. At the risk of sounding even more ethereal, it occurred to me that, you know, if it's something like this, we're trying to get, if we fill up this little water jar, we're going to have achieved something. I think that we started off with a pretty blue, sunny day. And with this, people are more comfortable with words and language, and they read in that the concepts. And so with these presentations today and even some of the specific thoughts you've heard, those are kind of like the clouds. And eventually we're going to have to get some rain out of those clouds. To go home and have a product. And so I believe we're moving in that direction. And I think you're going to see, as I capsulize some of my thoughts, and Representative Thiessen helped me, and Bradley, and others who are here, bring forward actually words that you'll feel more like you're in a regular division or a committee. And I think we're into that phase coming up here pretty quick. We do have, the time has gotten awfully short, but I don't think we could have shortened this process up a whole lot. But we wanted to present some thoughts and the ideas we needed to hear as a division and as a body to maybe proceed with a project, even as with the quality of House File 2, which I voted for. The Senate wasn't in full agreement with that, I think you could say. And so, well, you would have come home with, and some members of this committee weren't in agreement with that. And there were certain parts that I didn't like either, but it was a nice, but it was an example of some work that went forward.
We went downhill in a hurry, Mr. Chair.
Anyway, so, but so to send a product over that would be coming, that would spend another 2 months in conference committee or not get something done, may not serve as well as it likes. That's why I've done the method I've done, just so you understand where I'm going here. I hope that out of these, this process we've gone through, and people listening and learning, and all of us moving up a couple notches in our expertise, that you'll see some consensus arising. I've not polled any members to know where the consensus is going to be, so that'll be interesting to see where even Representative Thiessen and I, well, Helton and I agree on a few things. So I think that this is a good time to start talking amongst yourselves. What do you think we can do? I like the idea about some disclosure things, like Representative Goodwin's idea. I think that that's a real big deal. I think there's some room for report cards. There's some room for consumer empowerment. There's some room for best practices. And there's a lot of room. There's something to do with alternative practices as well, as we heard today, a compelling example about what we don't do that we know works better and cheaper. That's an interesting thing to me. So that's meant to be the commercial segment of our meeting, so you can know that we are going somewhere. If you have language, either as a committee member, a division member, or as a member of the audience or listening to this CD 3 months from now, too late, by the way, if you're on the CD. But there will be another version of this coming next year, I think. But if you have language and specific ideas and things you think we ought to proceed with, this is your time to bring them to me or to one of the members and bring them into the mix for solid presentation. If also you're on the staff, I think you can look forward to drafting language pretty quick here. It's actually going to happen. So with that being said,
I just wanted to comment, Mr. Chair, and on Representative Bradley's sheet here, item number 4, which is electronic medical records, and not to bring up the privacy issue, but a whole different issue just came up to me in the last week, and that's that so many clinics or hospitals or systems are starting to use different electronic medical records, and they're all proprietary, and they all have proprietary software. And for those of us that have lived through the fight between Apple and Microsoft, it's likely to rise again. And I've told you before, in my community, two hospitals, St. Mary's and St. Luke's, one's spending $40 million on information technology, they're spending $20 million, and they can't talk to each other. So if they take me to the wrong hospital, my records won't be available. And the one that came up this week, somebody representing the physician's assistants. And physician's assistants are authorized to write prescriptions under tight control of a physician who they work for. But the computer program that they're using in a certain southeastern part of this state, Representative Bradley.
Was it M, first letter?
There's only a slot on their program. It's great. They can have authorized the prescription, send the prescription right to the pharmacy over the internet, and they have it right there, and it's all filled out, except there's only room for one name and the prescriber, and the laws basically say that it has to be signed by a physician. And so this computer program will not allow a physician assistant to order a prescription that's completely legal for that individual to do. It's part of the kinds of problems we're going to face.
We're changing the law. Not changing the software, we're changing the law, right?
Well, that's what, you know, these kinds of decisions, and somehow I think the state and the feds are going to have to try to convince all these different groups that are doing this to set up programs that at least can talk to each other, you know, and have some flexibility in it. It's going to be a, because we're going to spend, this society is going to spend a huge amount of money on information technology and healthcare in the next 5 years, and hopefully it will be spent in a cost-effective way.
There's a niche for the Humvee system that could become.
Well, I was, Mr. Chair, I was an Apple guy, being an academic, and we hated Microsoft, but Apple almost went out of business because they weren't adaptable.
Excellent point. And just one final thing while you're also here. You'll see some bills coming with my name on the top of them. I think you'll see 4 coming in tomorrow. Those are working ideas. I don't endorse the idea in there, but just to get, you know, that's something that I'm working on with some senators. And then also the MMA bill will have my name on it, too. And so we're going to be considering all those ideas. So just stay tuned. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think one of those bills gets at this issue that Representative Huntley was just talking about, if I'm not mistaken. So that's good. Thank you. I have two bills to talk about, which may not fit within the water bottle you have over there for this year, but should as we move forward. The first one, I'm going to just turn it over to Jim Koppel from the Children's Defense Fund, if I could do that. That's House File 132. Save us some time. And
welcome, Mr. Koppel. Nice to see you again, and yeah, do you need some help with the page here?
Sure.
What those are for?
Let's
I had brought along this fact sheet that you just distributed on me. I won't pass that out.
That's fine.
Save those.
And just bear in mind, and I appreciate our discussion before. Remember, this division is interested in the private market in particular, but what affects the public market also has an impact on us.
Absolutely.
Go to town.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the division. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the director of the Children's Defense Fund. And the bill that we are talking about today is the Children's Health Security Act. Representative Thiessen is the chief author. And what I have passed around is just a quick, what is a, generally a PowerPoint, but a description of our current market and then what the Children's Health Security Act can do. I'd like to just start out by saying that, you know, I think a lot of the discussion in the private or public sector is not only over the cost of the healthcare system, which is the highest in the world, but the complication of the healthcare system, which is also the most complicated healthcare system in the world, whether you're trying to get insurance or trying to get care. And so the rather than lay out the problems, which are kind of bulleted for you on the first couple of pages, the key point here in both cases is that the system is very complicated in addition to being costly. And what we are attempting to do with this legislation is to take children first and move all the children in the state of Minnesota into a consolidated pool, contract with an intermediary who would manage that pool with public oversight, and then provide health care coverage for every child in the state. If you look on the fourth page in, you'll see that we currently spend about $3 billion a year in health care coverage. Two-thirds of that is private. What's interesting is if you look at the employee premiums, the individual plans, which are individual families buying coverage, private plan out-of-pocket costs, you'll see that, in other words, parents pay, are the largest payer for health care in the state of Minnesota in the private sector. Parents pay a little over a third of the health care costs in Minnesota. Employers and public pay are about the same. So what we have tried to do is take that $3 billion number, provide health care costs to every child in the state through this pool, and we found that in doing so, we could save the state of Minnesota money. Now, where it interacts with the private market in a big way is that children would no longer receive health care coverage through their employer, through their parents' employer. I'm sorry. We don't have not get into child labor laws here.
That's a different committee.
Yes. But through their parents' employer, so that employers, as you see on page 4, employers currently pay $860 million a year in premiums for their employees' children, they would no longer be responsible for that cost or that responsibility. All children in Minnesota over time would have available to them this large pool that they would go into and be guaranteed coverage from birth through age 18, and in fact through age to age 25 if they are a full-time college student and still a dependent. We can do all of this for less than $3 billion that the state of Minnesota currently spends. In this state of Minnesota, we currently spend. We currently spend $3 billion publicly and privately. We estimate, and we still have to have the actuarials come in and cross the T's and dot the I's to all of this. So that's forthcoming. But we estimate that this would cost somewhere around $2.7 billion. That covers every single child with a Minnesota Care comprehensive benefit package. Now, does that sound too good to be true? It isn't too good to be true. That all is true. The difference is how we finance the system. If employers don't pay $870 million in premiums, that is a savings to employers, but those costs don't go away. So we need to find a way to make up those costs. The way we bring in this program is in phase one, We would consolidate all of our public programs, all children in public programs. There's 320,000 children that receive public health care coverage in Minnesota, but they receive it in multiple programs. We would bring those into one pooled program, and we would open eligibility to 300% of poverty. By going to 300% of poverty, you bring in about 300,000 more children. So you'd have about 620,000 children in. We would pay through for that phase one, which is for every child under 300, living in a household with less than 300% of poverty. We would pay for that with a dollar cigarette tax. I realize that if all the dollar cigarette taxes pass this year, we'll have a very expensive pack of cigarettes. But we justify this by saying that it's a win-win situation for children, and that this would cover, this would provide the money to cover every child in families up to 300% of poverty, and also would have a distinct 10 to 15% decrease in the number of adolescents smoking. So you affect children's lives two ways. I want to make it clear that under 300% of poverty means all children in Minnesota in families under 300%, whether they get their care through an employer currently, their coverage through or not, they would all be eligible to come into this pool. And as I mentioned, that's about half of the children in Minnesota. Following that first phase, which we put in for 2 years of this phase of getting all the children in Minnesota in public programs and under 300% of poverty into this pool, we would then move to phase two, which would be allowing all children and young adults, full-time college students who are still dependents, to come into this pool. That's a total of a little over 1.4 million children and young adults in the end when you add all of that together. And the estimated cost for that is about $2.7 billion. Now, we also think that there need to be money put into the reimbursement system. But what I'm saying is that we're insuring many more children than we currently insure in the state that we spend $3 billion on, and we're doing it for less. The final thing I would add is that once you have these pools and you have a private intermediary managing these pools, you will be able, and I haven't even taken this into the cost savings, but the continuous care for children, they're not in and out of coverage, they're getting the primary care, they're getting preventive care, and the long-term savings of every child in Minnesota growing up to their healthiest that they can be, and so that we're not paying for negligent health condition the rest of that child and adult's life. We're actually preventing illness with the most preventable group of our population, which are children. So those savings will be enormous. It will go right through adulthood. We haven't added that even into this formula. So that's, in a nutshell, what the program is. We realize it's systemic change. It's a big change from how we do it now. But we think it's doable for two main reasons. Children are cheaper. Children cost about 60% of what an adult costs. And we cover most of our children now. We just do it through a very complicated way. But we don't have as many uninsured children as we have adults.
Thanks, Mr. Koppel. I forgot. You were on that, and you told me that this presentation was interesting. What was the base care plan? Was it medical assistance?
Or Minnesota Care Benefit Minnesota Package. Okay. For children.
All right, okay. So,
which is a broad, it's not the limitations that adult care has.
Thank you. And just a few comments, just to kind of echo and build on that last idea. I think one of the things that, you know, we do need to start thinking more boldly about some of this stuff. One of my concerns about kind of some of the, for instance, with the governor's budget that's coming in, is that we're just pushing costs around instead of making systemic changes, which could actually get at some of the root causes here. And I think this is one of those ideas that is kind of a bold way to kind of rethink how we get at health care in Minnesota and in the country, I suppose. And really, one of the things that was most striking to me about the report that you handed out, this health insurance report, is it finally showed in black and white what I think people have been noticing for a long time, which is that the employer-based market is under a lot of pressure and is deteriorating, and I think that that trend is going to continue. And so we need, so continued reliance on an employer-based market, I think, is something we really need to think seriously about, whether that is the best for the long-term future of healthcare in this country. And this is another way to look at that issue. So, and this point about continuous care is the last point I'd like to emphasize. I do think that if we get people health insurance and good health insurance and get it to them early, it is going to save us a lot of money, something we can't take into account in our budgeting here because we just can't work that way. But the long-term savings of getting kids immunizations, getting preventative care when they're young, not only in terms of their future health care but in how they do in school and all of these other areas where health care kind of the waves ripple out, I think this is worthy of really serious consideration. I hope that as we move forward, whether it's this year or in the future, that we do take some serious thought about this and ask some hard questions, but really take it seriously. I'd like to thank you for all your work on this.
Samuel, the governor's for bold reforms. So he is bold, so I think that might be one of his criteria. So maybe he's. Maybe Mr. Barks, do you know offhand? Made some homework for you. And he loved it. People love when I call on him. But do you know offhand for later on, this is Minnesota Care Benefits set, and the providers are paid a little less than your normal plans are. Do you know offhand the differential, what it might be? Just let us know that. Maybe get us an email. Well, there's a normal employer, like the state plan pays something and the normal employer plans. I know that, and so there's a $300 million differential, and I know there's no state lines, but it's as you compare apples to apples, see what the consideration. Any other members got a question? You're not thinking this is going to go right off in the consent calendar.
Well, I have so many problems with this, but I don't want to take too much time. At least I have to know philosophically, because I have to know, Representative Thiessen, Mr. Koppel, are you in favor then of socialized government-run medicine? Because that's what this is.
Well, I don't think that it is socialized government medicine. It is allowing the private market to continue to work. It's just having the payer be different than who the payer is right now. That, I think, is the serious difference. I mean, the word socialism gets tossed out a lot, and I think in ways that people don't understand what socialism really is, but we don't have to get into that debate tonight. Maybe Jim has another response.
You want to go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, no, and that's not the intention. The intention is to simplify the system, to keep it managed in the private sector, to have a broad provider network, to, I think, actually brings back administrative simplicity and removes a lot of frustrations that providers have expressed that get in the way of them practicing medicine today, from paperwork to multiple pre-authorizations, et cetera, and all the different management that we do. We almost over-manage health care. So it isn't really to bring government into this system. We try to keep the system privately managed and run. It's really just to consolidate the funding sources and not burden various areas of our population and make it depend on how much parents make and where they work as to whether their children are going to grow up in a good health care environment.
Did that help, Mr. Redman?
No, but let me at least make a couple of comments because I certainly believe in problem solving, and we have the lowest level of uninsured in the nation, and particularly amongst children. Those who are uninsured, every profile that I see basically says they're already eligible for public assisted health care insurance, or their families have decided that they can cover themselves. So we're chasing a problem here that's not quite clear to me. And I would say if you think that the solution is having whatever you want to call the model, but government run, I guess maybe you ought to go out and talk to providers about Medicare and how happy they are with Medicare, or maybe you ought to go out and talk to providers and see how happy they are with Medicaid and the levels of payment and the system and how uncomplicated it is. I can take you through a parade of dentists and have them tell you how wonderful it was to try to go on and to have their bills paid in this easy, automated system. I think this is a fantasy, but whatever.
Fair enough.
Well, Mr. Chair, I got to jump in on that one. this is a bold approach to put all our kids into a somewhat streamlined system compared to what we have today. And yes, it would save money. And one of the articles you handed out, Mr. Chair, is from the New Republic, and I think everybody ought to read that. Unfortunately, what you handed out is only the first half of the article.
Oh, my God.
That's what's all you got off the internet. Certainly physicians aren't real happy with the system we have in this country today, and all the other industrialized nations seem to have figured out a way to cover everybody and at a third to a half the cost that we spend. And in addition to that, they have better outcomes. If you want one example, one I usually use, if you look at kids dying around the time of birth, we're the worst in the industrialized world in this country, and yet we have the best and most expensive neonatal intensive care units in the world. Yet we have the worst perinatal mortality rate. And other countries have figured out better ways to do it. And I think ensuring, you know, the there's all kinds of talk about rationing, but when you kick people off of programs or don't supply them with health care, that's just simply another way to ration. And we do it in this country.
Anybody else? Representative Tisa, thank you.
Just a quick question. What's the basis for really looking at pulling all the kids together in the whole state versus allowing people with private programs or whatever to continue?
Mr. Koppel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuelson, the idea is that you would still have choice of those providers and private markets in this pool. It's just a large purchasing pool. The children would still be able to, or their parents and families would still make those choices. The rationale was that we currently, parents disproportionately are paying more and more and more for that healthcare system through their premiums. It's almost a 50-50 undertaking with employers. It's not a very affordable system in that private market for parents today, and this would be a way of assuring that they would have that affordability while keeping that choice available.
But they would, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, they would basically still be doing it through a private market?
Yes, they would still be choosing their providers, having that choice would be theirs, yes.
Mr. Samuelson, got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. One more bill?
Well, yeah.
Any more bills there? Yeah.
I got one more.
Any reinsurance questions?
And this one, it's, I'm not even sure what the House file, 819, I guess.
Why don't you start, and then I think... Hey, Bill. Come on down. Sorry for the delay. You're up right now.
I gotta go downstairs a little bit.
Okay, actually, what we're looking for is a 5-minute synopsis of House File
553. Members of the committee, I'm Bill Straczynski, and I do represent the Minnesota Regional Service Agencies, and Chairman Knobloch, because the office of Bill's on his way down. Just
feel like you better anyway, so go ahead. That's a Knobloch. We're just looking for a 3 or 4 or 5 minute summary of House File 563.
Sure.
Take a deep breath first. And just kind of welcome to the Healthcare Division.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, it's good to be here. My apologies for being late on your agenda when I had planned on being early, but the speaker called and other business came up, and so I need to be late. House File 563 deals with the way of providing additional health insurance options to people around the state of Minnesota. What it does is it allows service cooperatives who currently serve the public sector to
provide their and sell their health insurance products to the private sector. There are currently 7 service cooperatives around the state of Minnesota. They insure, I think, about 150,000 lives in the state. They have 709 health insurance plans right now with different counties, cities, and school districts. They, of course, have been around in various forms. Originally, we're called, I think, educational cooperative service units. They've been known as service cooperatives the last several years. They get no state funding. They are nonprofits. They are cooperatives, but they function as a way to try to hold down costs for local units of government. And this idea just came to me when I was meeting with my local service cooperative in St. Cloud a few years ago. They were telling me about the products they have. I felt that they have a lot of good health insurance products that would be particularly useful for people in small businesses who, especially in greater Minnesota right now, often don't have many choices. In greater Minnesota, oftentimes all you have is one provider, Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I felt, look, this would be an opportunity to have one other health insurance provider out there that could provide some competition and some choice for people. And so it's with that spark of local initiative that I brought this bill forward, and I think it's a great idea, and I'd appreciate your support.
I have a question. Did you want to say something else?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to put the words right out of my mouth.
I have a question probably for you, but now these pools, pooling is a big issue and the big term. So let's say pick up a company that's got people that wants to use your services. Would they be in their own pool, or would they be allowed to join? There's a public-private, but if say you had a bunch of small companies, would they all be in the same pool together?
I believe that the bill actually provides that there would have to be a separate pool for the private sector. You wouldn't be mixing for-profit companies with school districts or counties or cities. They'd have their own special pool, and there's a variety of ways you could start that. You could ask for a reserve amount to be put down by the various businesses that were getting into the pool. You could require them to commit to being in for a period of years so that they had some sort of guaranteed cash flow for a period of time with which they would have the capacity to front the pool. But no, you wouldn't be mixing it with the public sector.
Is this a self-insured kind of pool?
It's a self-insured kind of pool, yes.
It's under ERISA then?
Yes.
Okay, and so they would put their reserves up, and then it would be almost like a MIWA then. Only it's with their service co-ops.
Basically.
So you would probably bring 50-person things together and have a 750-member pool then with that. And they would share a pool, and they would then all pay the same rates. They'd be in a pool together, and based upon...
Already. I think that's the idea, Mr. Chairman. There's some more research obviously needs to take place on that. But yes, that's the concept.
Yeah. Members have questions?
Yes, sir, Huntley. Mr. Chair and either witness there, currently when let's say it's a city or a school district is insured through the ESO, are they purged, not merged, but pooled with everybody, or are they in a separate pool by themselves in terms of underwriting, determining the illness rate of their members?
Mr. Szczesinski.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in this case, actually, local units of government currently have their own pool in a region, with the service in that region.
Mr. Chair, are they all pooled together, or is each one an individual pool?
Mr. Chairman, Huntley, we're pooled on a regional basis, so those local units of government are in one pool in that region, okay, and then school districts are also in a pool in that region, so that you do have, but they do then does affect your individual claims experience to some extent. The pooling certainly gives them regional buying opportunities, so we price regionally, and we do negotiate currently on a statewide basis, however, with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. On our current operations. But yes, it's a regional basis.
We have 7 regional pools, actually, so that's how
we work. And businesses, we envision kind of the same thing on that scenario, on a regional basis. So you can take advantage of local hospital pricing and whatever on that region.
Within that region, I mean, costs
or whatever. Not a statewide actuarial pool, but comparing metro costs versus rural Minnesota costs.
That's not easy.
Well, I just my comment. And all these things that involve pooling, unless there are ways to keep people in those pools, ultimately the employers with healthy employees will get a better rate someplace else and get out and leave the employers with sick employees in the pool. So you need, I think Representative Nonblock did mention some incentives to or penalties if they pull out.
Mr. Szczesinski. Well,
currently, they do, there's a penalty. They have to remain in the pool today under our current scenarios. We would envision, I suspect, similar things. That's certainly true. You have to stay in the pool for a period of time. I think it's interesting. We just added in January and February, I think, Bell County County, Crow Wing Counties came in. The service cooperative model that you all created here, actually, it has 650 different public entities cooperating today. And that's pretty big. Nobody else is doing it.
650
public entities are cooperating today through our service cooperative models. Mr. Nadler, the policy of the legislature to pass legislation such as Mr. Nadler is proposing, we're happy to try and bring some of the experience we have to that same model.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just can't I can't resist, but it sounds like socialized medicine to me.
Pulling in a death chair. Just another question or two. So, talking to Mr. Szczesinski, the way you as you set up these plans in the co-op, they're just the regular co-op kind of plans, and you administer a plan that's overlaid under some. You bought some health product underneath, right? And so Blue Cross is in your area, then that you'd be using Blue Cross as the underlying plan, right?
Mr. Chairman, under this model, that's yet to be determined, I guess. I think currently we use Blue Cross and Blue Shield. We do go out for bid and periodically to determine who the underlying vendor will be. This currently we do work with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. On a statewide basis, that's the benefit of our pooling and our savings of administrative fees and some of those kinds of things. I think that is yet to be determined. For a private pool, but Blue Cross
should be one. I'm just trying to figure this out, so I appreciate the dialogue, because Representative Nadler said that some places only Blue Cross is the only choice they got. And so if you offer a product with an overlay management on top of a Blue Cross product, did you really change anything?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I can respond to that.
Does that make sense?
Well, I think you have. I mean, in the first place, you have the service cooperatives have been, I think, branching out into some new policies, new types of policies. They were very early on advocates of health savings accounts when Blue Cross wasn't maybe pushing those quite as much. And so I think that the service cooperatives have provided some additional choices that wouldn't exist if you just had Blue Cross themselves in the market. Beyond that, this is getting to be a fairly good-sized group of organizations now. When you talk about how many lives are covered, they certainly have the capacity to go to someone else and say, well, you know, if we don't like Blue Cross, we can go to maybe Health Partners or Medica or someone else and look at an overlay there, or look at various reinsurance plans at a certain level and kind of mix and match a little bit in terms of setting up a set of products for people. So while they have been affiliated with Blue Cross, I don't think that they are required to be affiliated with Blue Cross for this to work.
Mr. Chairman, again, it's all voluntary.
No, I appreciate it. We're just going to kind of fun to talk about.
I think, Mr. Chairman, at the risk of getting too complicated, I think the State Employee Insurance Program, CBIP, I think had issues in the past for your own insurance program where you've had different carriers, you know, where the employees had a choice, you want to go with this carrier, that carrier, whatever. That was a dilemma for the State Employee Insurance Program. You know, we have not allowed that to happen in our current structure. We have a carrier, everybody's in.
And this is one last question I have, and then I appreciate you stopping in today. Pretty busy day. If you're overlying any plan, I don't care who you pick as the underlying plan, then you really aren't self-insured so much as you're administering a plan, and so it wouldn't be the same as a true self-insurance product. Right? Is that
We'll just discuss this some more later.
Let me ask.
Introduce someone from the service cooperatives here, and then I can take a crack at that question. Sure. Go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chairman, I work as an insurance consultant to Dan Weir, to the service cooperative, the Resource in the Northwest. I'll give you an example. In the consumer directed area in 2002, we filed service cooperative plans with the Commerce Department as organizations, and were approved for service cooperative health plans themselves. So the the health insurance plan is administered by Blue Cross, but certified by the service cooperatives. The service cooperatives are self-funded.
Right.
And the way we manage the risk on a pooled basis, in partial answer to your question as well, is the first $50,000 of claims for any individual go against that experience of that group. We, on a regional basis at Resource in the Northwest, share between $50,000 and $300,000, and we buy reinsurance above $300,000. So you have the synergies and efficiencies of the best rates for the most efficient group with only the claims up to $50,000, with the purchasing power of buying stop loss at $300,000 and then leveraging on a regional basis the contingency between. So we've developed a model over 15 years, and it's been very successful.
I appreciate it. I think we're out of time, but there was a helpful thing. Mr. Pender especially probably got it. Thank you very much. I appreciate stopping in. If you have no more questions, we'll invite you back.
Right, I'll say one last comment. I know that the issue has come up sometimes as to whether you pay MCHA taxes and such here, and they do. So just want to make sure that that's clear as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thanks. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Are you still here? Yeah, thanks. So the next member here. Welcome to the committee.
Glad to be here, Mr. Chairman.
Looking for a 5 minute or less summary of your idea, just so we can say we heard your idea here. So,
sure.
Remember, what was your bill? You were,
Mr. Chairman. I have what? Pardon?
588 was
588. I have given the page a copy of the booklet. Now, some of you have seen it already. If you've been in the committees that have seen it already, so if you want to. If you want to take it, if not, I'll keep it for the next group that I talk to on this. But this summarizes all the mandates throughout the country, state by state, with Minnesota leading the nation, number one in mandates, which fall into three categories, providers, insured persons, and benefits. And the bill that is moving through the process started out as benefits and providers. Now it's just benefits. Smiles all around.
Improvement to the bill.
So basically, what it does is for small employers, which is defined as 2 employees to 50, may adopt a flexible benefit plan, and those benefit plans must have some kind of cost sharing arrangements in them, like copays and deductibles, or some kind of combination of those. And also, they're exempt from the state benefit mandates, but still subject to the handful of them that we have at the federal level under the ERISA law. But what we passed in, I forget, 2000, and never really went into effect because of some issues that were involved in implementing it. So this takes care of some of those issues, but the piece I want to point out to you, I don't know, do you have the bill in your packet?
We do.
There's on page 2, line 18, that paragraph is something that I wanted to do, having come from the insurance industry. Nothing would bother me more than when an insured thought something was covered and it's not, and this is to clarify and educate the consumer what is not in here. So the idea is to have kind of a side-by-side comparison that shows a standard Minnesota healthcare policy and one that's under the flexible benefit plan. And it says item by item what's covered and what's not covered with these mandates. And the reason why it's called flexible benefit plan is it doesn't have to be a total stripped-down model. They can build back coverages depending on what the needs of that particular company and their employees are. This whole area has been an element of discussion throughout. Representative Goodwin and I have had discussions on this, in both in the Commerce Committee and the Full Health Committee. And I've provided her some wording that Mr. Pender drafted to make sure that the disclosure goes to the individuals, the employees, too. Which it's, I think, a difficult thing to draft because there's some ERISA law that creeps in there and says that we can't dictate certain things. But I think that wording works, according to Mr. Pender, or it's at least a good crack at it. So, but I think that's a very important feature of this bill. But I'm open to questions. It's not a end-all solution by any means. You know, if we didn't have health care cost issues, we probably wouldn't be looking at this. But we found that, especially with health savings accounts, when companies can save money, when individuals can save money, they're more likely to carry coverage. And this is one way to help provide a lower cost alternative and address some of the uninsured problem.
Members, Representative Goodman. You raising your hand?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin. What happens, though, I'm still wondering what happens to, it seems to me like the people that will be left in the regular system, in a regular health plan, will be the ones with the most severe problems, maybe, or the older people, or whatever. And what happens to those plans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, that's what I think it's not a problem under this bill, because this bill is talking about the small group market. It's not talking about individuals. Right. So you're not going to get the kind of individual adverse selection that you're concerned about, because an employer is going to have to opt to offer this option, not on an individual basis. So I think there's some protection against that.
Absolutely. Help me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, the maternity benefits was the major issue in previous attempts at this. And if I remember, federal law requires employers with 15 of our employees to cover maternity benefits. And then the fight was over the 1 to 14. And does your bill require maternity benefits for any female employee, despite the size of the company?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, no. It goes with the federal standard.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkins, then you would be exempting companies of 1 to 14.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, that is correct, although it's flexible, so they can buy it back. They just have the flexibility of, you know, if they can afford the coverage, my guess is they'll do it. I don't think for a minute that every employer is going to flock to this. I really don't. I think there's a real attraction to provide a fuller benefit set. But for some that are struggling either with whether they're even going to have coverage or not, whether they can drop coverage or whether they can add coverage, this helps the marginal employers to be able to offer some level of coverage.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, is there the potential here for an employer to have some better coverage for some of their employees and not as good a coverage for other employees? Could they split it up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I think there's, and I can't cite it, maybe Mr. Pender can, but they would get in some deep, deep trouble discriminating between employees. Whether they offer two different levels of coverage and let the employee pick, I think that's probably a reasonable assumption to say that some would, although small employers tend to offer one option. They just don't have the critical mass to be able to offer the kind of cafeteria type, three different packages like some larger employers have. But they couldn't just say, all right, this group of people gets this stripped down model and the rest of us get the management group or something get this other one.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, that already happens in some of the school districts where the administrators get a much better plan or 100% paid coverage, and they get post-retirement coverage, and the teachers don't, for example. And that's one of the reasons that the administrators are fighting that the statewide health insurance plan. But so if nothing prevents them from doing that, what prevents small employers from doing that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I'm speculating here, but I suspect that's because there's collective bargaining units, and that would be the distinction. But that you couldn't, as a small employer, you couldn't say, you know, one group of my employees can have one thing and another, unless there's a collective bargaining situation. But if there's not, my guess is there's some laws to prevent that kind of discrimination. I don't know what they are, and I'm sure our research people can find them for us. But
Nelson, we're going to go to the floor sometime, so I suggest you might want to figure that out. That's a good question to ask, and you can. That's I think a worthy question, just so people can. Yeah.
Maybe Mr. Pender could help me with that.
Yeah. He needs more to do. So he was lacking for projects. Get the last question.
Mr. Chair, I'm back to the maternity. Representative Goodwin talked about discriminating between two different groups of employees, and certainly it discriminates between males and females in the 1 to 14 group. And what I was wondering is there anything in this bill that exempts this benefit package from meeting all the other requirements of state law that talk about non-discrimination between sexes?
Mr. Chairman, that would be the sections at the beginning and the end, because of the maternity issue, talk about exempting it specifically from the human rights statute so that they can offer this benefit. That was kind of the rub when it prevented it from being implemented in the first place. But there's no worse discrimination than not being able to afford coverage at all.
Well, Mr. Chair, two things could happen if this puts into place. If it's a good labor market, women of childbearing age won't apply for jobs in these companies that don't offer that benefit. And if it's a bad labor market, we will be discriminating against women, and we will be in effect violating other sections of our law on equal rights.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that we can ever come to an agreement on this. Representative Huntley and I just see it differently. I see this as an opportunity to offer coverage to people who don't currently have coverage. And it may not be the most ideal. My guess is most employers will still opt for that particular coverage, but they'll have the flexibility to, design the package that meets their needs. And I'm never going to represent this as the perfect plan, but it's one option for companies that are struggling to offer minimum health care benefits.
Thanks. It's nice to have you on the hot seat here.
Appreciate the invitation.
So thank you. We'll see you a week from today back here.
There we go.
Watch the room. It might be this room. So we're adjourned. Thank you very much.